The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. Hey, the Time magazine just recently ran a story on the 100th anniversary of Planned Parenthood.
And it's difficult to believe that in 1916, actually in October 16 of 1916, Margaret Sanger founded this organization. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think it's been 100 years this thing's been going.
Well, it was regarded as quite a big event too. President Obama tweeted out, "For a century, Planned Parenthood has made it possible for women to determine their own lives. Here's to another hashtag 100 years strong."
Yeah, and then Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, took a picture with Cecile Richards, the CEO of Planned Parenthood, and he sent out a congratulatory tweet, again, with the hashtag 100 years strong.
So should we be excited about these last 100 years of Planned Parenthood? That's the question.
Yeah. As I was reading through the article, it was basically talking about how Planned Parenthood got started by Margaret Sanger. And I mean,
did they bring up any of the controversial stuff?
Not really. Nothing like the connection to eugenics or anything like that.
And if that word, by the way, is new to you, eugenics is a Greek word for well-born. Mm-hmm. And basically is speaking to, what life is worth living, really. Mm-hmm. And when should somebody either be sterilized or
now, have we seen much of that in Canada? I think it's more United States.
Well, no, that's a good question. From my research, I don't think that Canada's hands are clean in this by any stretch with what was done with Native Americans here or our First Nations people. Mm-hmm. But it is important to note, by the way, that eugenics got its going in the West. I think a lot of people think of Nazi Germany when they think eugenics,
right.
But they were just inspired by the West.
Yeah, that was their defense, I guess, at the Nuremberg trial or whatever. And over again, they said, we just took from what you guys were doing in the United States.
It is important to note, though, that eugenics got its going from Darwinian evolution, and I'm forgetting the guy's name. I should have looked this up. It was Darwin's, it was a relative, actually, of Darwin. He was the half-cousin of Darwin. His name is Francis Galton.
Never heard that name before.
Yeah, so he's the one who got it started, and in the West, we ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm pretty sure he's from the UK, but
well, if it's Darwin's cousin, I'm sure it's somewhere around there.
Yeah.
This article didn't necessarily mention anything like that, but it did kind of, I mean, for those of you who have been listening to the podcast, you probably know that my opinion of Planned Parenthood is pretty low. But at the same time, like I do want to give the credit where it's due. This article was talking about how Planned Parenthood got started, and they were really actually, Margaret Sanger and her friends were actually concerned about women's rights. Right? And I think the intention at least was really good.
I would agree. I think that a lot of people don't realize that the feminist movement, which ultimately was a part of all of this, had its foundations in a positive place. I mean, women didn't have the right to vote, didn't have the right to own property. There were lots of things that they couldn't do that was wrong. I mean, they should have the right to vote, to own property or whatever that is. I mean, and they were fighting for good things is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. But then ultimately these would continue on into what would be noted as second and third wave feminism.
Mm-hmm. I thought the article did an interesting job. I felt very almost partial to their cause at the beginning, because these women who are coming forward trying to seek help at this, I guess the first Planned Parenthood office, were feeling like, okay, they have 8 kids already, and they are just being used by their husbands or by men as objects to basically have kids. And then your job is, okay, you're an object who has a kid, and you raise it, and that's your value to me.
Well, and apparently a lot of them, too, there was a lot of abuse that was going on at that time, and women just, they didn't have a lot of rights to fight back of the abuse that they were experiencing.
Yeah, and that's what happens, right? When you don't have any legal rights, you can't exactly fight this. This is now a systemic thing, and you can't really fight this effectively. And any victory that you achieve, it comes at a great cost.
Mm-hmm. So as Planned Parenthood began to build and grow as an organization, and it did quite quickly. I mean, these days, it's amazing just how many places that it is. Mm-hmm. But it grew fast.
Yeah, there are international offices too, right?
Oh, like yeah, tons of international offices. But then quite quickly, their focus started to change of what they began to advocate for. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they began to advocate for was birth control, and then quite quickly began to advocate for abortion.
One of the arguments that I often hear from my pro-choice acquaintances and friends is precisely that, right? If you force motherhood on these women, you're basically degrading them, right? Mm. You're dehumanizing them. You're turning them into vessels for childbearing, and that's all you're doing.
Which, by the way, the organization was first called American Birth Control League. And so it's interesting to me that you start to see this this slippery slope, if you will, right? Because, and this is something that I get when you hear a lot of the arguments that's made for abortion, is you often hear these hypothetical arguments. You often hear the extreme arguments, right? And then you'll hear this, it's their body, they're not cattle, you can't just, use them as baby making machines and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But the argument we often hear too then with abortion these days is with regards of what, there's an abortion called therapeutic abortion,
right?
Which is where you're seeking to save the life of the mm-hmm. of the mom, say if something's gone wrong with the pregnancy, and you've got to choose one of the lives. I mean, mm-hmm. you need some sort of legal recourse to be able to take the child's life so that the mom can live. Mm-hmm. So that's one form that we see. But then again, right? So, okay, I can see that, right? I mean, don't you guys see that where people put an argument for you?
That seems more like a pro-life sort of thing, because as opposed to losing two lives, we'll only lose one at this point. And that's...
A typical case that's often cited is ectopic pregnancy, right? When the zygote or the fertilized egg is not implanted inside the uterus, but in the fallopian tube, and it's not meant to be there.
Right.
And so if you don't detect it early on, it could rupture the fallopian tube, and the mother and the child, both of them, will most likely die. So mm-hmm. in that case, it's one or both of them. So if you have, if that's your option, then the pro-life thing to do is save at least one life.
Right.
Although,
now, at the same time, we would also argue, hey, we want our science to get to a place
right.
where we could save both. Like, the ideal is to save both. If you have to make a choice, which is a very difficult thing to do, well, then a choice is going to need to be made.
Yeah. I remember listening to Anthony Levitino. He is a former abortionist, licensed and practicing OBGYN. But now he's a pro-life activist, and he'll tell you over the course of his career, he's performed more than 1,200 abortions, but he stopped doing that, and now he advocates for
life. Did he say why he stopped doing it?
Part of the reason, from what I remember from that interview, which I will post on the show note, was that he, I guess, came to see the humanity of it. He actually he and his wife had trouble with infertility. They adopted one. And, by the grace of God, they had their own biological child. And I think it was at one point, one of the children, I forget which one, I think it might have been the biological one, got into a car accident and she died. And so then that kind of changed him. So then when he started doing more abortions, he started seeing his child, right? And at some point...
He started seeing the value of life.
Right. And at some... Because he started seeing the fingers and everything. And at some point he said, no, I can't do this. It took him like a couple months.
Do you know what I think is fascinating about that? Well, first of all, the point you're making, I think, is critical. How often do these hypothetical extreme cases actually take place?
Yeah.
It's rare. But then the other aspect of it is, so if we move away from those ones where, like, I can see that there can be warrant mm-hmm. for abortion, mm-hmm. right? I mean, when you have, you're going to have to choose a life here, and it's a difficult decision. The problem is that's not the problem we're facing mm-hmm. here, because ultimately there were laws that were put into place so that given those circumstances, something could be done. But then more hypotheticals came out, such as what if the girl gets raped? Or what if the child has a genetic mutation, you know, or
birth defect.
Thing, right? Yeah. And you start getting into all these other questions. And then, because this gets back to where you're going here, here's a doctor who saw the child humanized, right? The problem that we often see today is, you know, we've gone down this path that you can take a child's life for whatever reason now you want. I mean, Steve, here in Canada, there is no law, right?
Yeah. I think it's pretty shameful, but you're right.
So that now you can have an abortion for any reason you want at any point.
Yeah, up to the birth of the child.
And there's people like Peter Singer who would be willing to allow for, mm-hmm. you know, he'd be willing to put forth argumentation that that a child's life up to a certain age, and I've seen different numbers, could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think his logic, though, if you push it to its logical conclusion, that's where we're headed, is that, you know, you will look at...
Oh, he's being logically consistent.
And I would still argue against it, and I think it's wrong, but basically that's where it's going is a pig is worth more than a newborn child, as somebody put it, right? I think that was actually Peter Singer himself.
Oh, well, it's crazy to me. I mean, we'll often see that where people, like not too long ago, we had the Olympics here and they had too many sled dogs. You guys remember this?
No, I don't remember that.
And so they're like, well, we got to get rid of these sled dogs. So they shot them. People were up in arms that, you know, that a dog was killed. But no problem if a mom wants to take the life of her baby.
Oh, right. Dude. Well, that played out in the news recently. Remember when that gorilla was killed, Harambe?
Yeah.
Oh, right? And of course, the memes poured out, but that was the outrage was these people are freaking out about a gorilla that was endangering the life of a living child, right? And because they saved the child, they're like, no, we need to have justice for this gorilla because they put the gorilla's life higher than the child's.
Well, and that's the fascinating thing is they do put the gorilla's life higher than the child because on their logic, the gorilla is more rare than the child. See, one of the fundamental problems that we have in our culture that really allowed this slippery slope to quite quickly erode is that we as a culture don't value human life. And in fact, what we do is we don't even look at these children as children. We don't look at them as babies. We don't even call them that. We call them a fetus. I mean, how many times have we heard of the newborn just referred to as a clump of cells?
Yeah, or newborn as in like the not yet born, right? Preborn child. A clump of cells. Some of my friends have even called them parasites.
Wow.
So basically, I think what's happening here is you take, just like you said, Andy, right? People don't murder people. Whenever there is...
People murder monsters, exactly. And monsters murder people.
And so then what happens is, just like we've mentioned before, whenever a genocide happens, it doesn't just happen. There's always steps leading up to it. And the first step is dehumanization, right? So the Jews were referred to as rats. Was it Hutus or Tutsis?
Yep.
Anyway, you know, like tall trees to be cut down, that sort of thing. Yeah. And so...
Now the language continues with the babies. They're basically just cells.
But it raises a challenging question because is it wrong to kill cells, right? I mean, that because right now we are in an interesting time technologically because now this question of abortion is tied even closer to birth control than, I mean, it ever has been because birth control can work at different stages in the development pre-zygote and post-zygote, you know, fertilized egg. And I've seen this being challenged in areas of people that are going through a difficult time with fertility, right? And you see this with different infertility methods such as the in vitro fertilization, right? And so here, now what they're doing, they're taking out the egg, right? And they are fertilizing the egg and they've got a zygote now on like a petri dish, right?
Right.
And now, like, and I had a friend that just recently went through this, right? So now all of a sudden, I'm finding Christians finding themselves in these ethical dilemmas that they never expected to be in. I mean, they didn't even realize that technology could do some of the stuff that it can do. So that now you've got five fertilized eggs, and you're asking the question, what do I do with those? Right? Do you implant all five of them? Do you select some of them? Well, if you're only going to select some of them, should you check what sex they are? Should you check whether or not they're genetically viable? I mean, all these questions then are being raised, ethical dilemmas that you're being confronted with. And one of the fundamental questions that is being brought before you is, what is that fertilized egg? Hmm. Is it a person or not?
Right. And that's the first question that I always go to whenever I have dialogues on this issue is, what is that thing? Because after all, if Maya is playing behind my back and she says, Daddy, can I kill this? I would have to ask first, right? I would have to turn around and see what it is that she has in her hand or whatever, right? And so it always comes down to that.
When my boys say that, I'm greatly troubled. Dad, can I kill this? You know, you're not just going to be like, yeah, whatever, you know.
Okay.
Unless it's a spider, you kill it right away.
My boys have zero fear of spiders, so I'll often find them holding them, screaming, running, get it off.
They're braver than me.
But that, you know, ultimately, a baby is just a bunch of cells that have divided. So at what level of division now are we going to say...
You mean on their view, right?
Yes.
On the naturalistic view.
Yeah, right. Of course I don't believe that. But I mean, I do believe that they are a bunch of cells, mm-hmm. but are they more than a bunch of cells? And I'm going to say, well, of course they are, which raises the question, well, how can I say of course they are, right? Because that's the problem. At what level then is a society going to say that it is a human being? Now, I'm going to say it's a human being at conception. When it is a zygote egg, a fertilized egg, its purpose has changed. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, Steve, you've often talked about this.
Yeah.
Like if we, you know, I've heard you say before, if we were to leave it.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons, because actually not a friend, but an acquaintance brought that up, right? I mean, sure, you know, when you have an abortion, you're killing life. Well, so is a sperm and an egg. You know, how is this different from a fingernail, he said. I said, well, it's different from a fingernail because if you give it the proper environment, a fingernail will stay a fingernail. Same thing with the egg and the sperm. You give it the right environment, it'll stay as such. But once the egg is fertilized, once you have a zygote, given the right environment, it'll grow into an adult.
Now, this is interesting too, and I've talked about this before. That's actually how we define what a thing is, especially when we're talking about composite things that are made up of, that are complex entities that are made up of other things. That its purpose defines what it is, and so we would say, listen, if you leave that, its purpose it is going to be the development of a human being, and that's what it is. It is a human being, mm-hmm.
and you find that that there's that underlying unity. Right? Because when my friends come to me and we're talking about abortion and things like that, they'll always use some kind of an arbitrary criterion to determine when personhood begins.
Which right now it seems to be when the baby comes out of the uterus or whatever, right?
Yeah.
When it's born.
Right. Which then comes into another kind of inconsistency or absurdity where a 20-week premature baby all of a sudden has this legal right that a 39-week-old baby inside the womb doesn't have, right? And so it creates all kinds of problems, but you'll always find that if you try to peg humanity or personhood on some arbitrary quality that comes in degrees, then you run into all kinds of problems like this. And so then what you're looking for, how about this one? I'll just use this one example. Sometimes people say, well, you got to have self-awareness in order to become a person. I'm like, well, I sleep every night. Am I not a person anymore? Oh, they'll say, oh, that's different. That's different because you already had self-awareness and you're just kind of temporarily, you know, as you're sleeping, it's not there kind of a thing. Oh, so then what you're saying is there's this underlying unity underneath that consciousness. There's something that you can't violate. So then I would argue that that's personhood.
Well, and it's interesting because we've seen this played out as well, where they'll argue, well, if the thing feels pain, if it's a sentient being, Well, then it's not okay. So like once the baby gets to a stage in its development that it feels pain, well, then it's not okay. But it's interesting because they find out that the baby feels pain very, very early in development. Mm-hmm. And, but now all of a sudden, well, that's not going to work because it doesn't fit with.
You even see them like retract from the needle. Like they recognize it's there and you'll see them try and move away from it as if there's a needle in the area.
Which is just brutal, right? And I mean, speaks to the depravity of man that here people still want to argue for abortion, you know, at whatever, you know, here in Canada, we don't even have a law, right? Because it's not really down to whether or not the baby's feeling pain or not. It's all about, I just think about the narcissism of it all. Because basically the law comes down to, intriguingly enough, the Privacy Act. Like they ultimately, that's where they're going to have to, where the Supreme Court landed with this. I don't know how it worked out in Canada, but ultimately in the United States, with this being a woman's right with regards to her body and in her own privacy to determine what she wants to do.
Well, and to determine a woman's future, right? But like as Christians, we would say, well, do we actually determine our own futures or do we trust in the sovereign plan of God? Mm-hmm. Because the only thing it looks like right now is that they are determining to kill a life and they have no idea what their future is going to look like.
But to be fair, I think most people that I know anyway, who are pro-choice, they don't actually mean to kill a baby, right? Like, I mean, they genuinely believe that this is a clump of cells. They bought into that whole thing and they think this is a clump of cells. Whether it is, you know, just some of my friends trying to convince themselves this is the case, or they are just genuinely believe, I'd much rather just give them the benefit of the doubt and say they actually truly believe that this is a clump of cells. So then what I would want to do is actually show them, no, that this is not the case. There's a good philosophical case for the humanity of the unborn, preborn, and there's a scientific case.
And I think it's got to ultimately be both. If I were to critique the pro-life movement, I think one of the mistakes that they've made, I'm curious your thoughts on this, Steve, is oftentimes when you see their displays, you'll often see a progression of human life with these, you know, little plastic dolls going from small to big. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like one of the arguments that fundamentally I see is if it looks like a baby, it's a baby. Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate that on the one hand, that's a good argument in that if you want to show the humanity and you want to humanize this, what is being referred to as a fetus in a clump of cells, that's helpful. But the problem is, That hasn't helped people that are now dealing with in vitro questions and other questions of things that don't look like babies. They're fertilized cells.
In fact, you can't even really see it with naked eyes, right?
Right.
But I think just to give you pushback a little bit, since you asked what I think about it, I think the point isn't so much to kind of make the case that if it looks like a baby, then it's a human being. It's more that, I mean, even at 10 weeks, you can see all these features. So it is not the case that, you know, they're... So it becomes more difficult to deny the humanity of it.
Right. And I would agree with that. I guess what I'm saying is, I think it has to be a stronger argument than just it looks like a baby.
Right.
Yeah. You've got to buttress this with a philosophical argument that can help deal with what about those stages in which it doesn't look like a baby?
In fact, the interesting thing is when I talk on this, I will often cite different textbooks, embryology textbooks, in fact, because different embryology textbooks, they will say, I have like a collection of 41 different quotes from different medical textbooks, embryology textbooks that I got off of this website. And they all say, you know, medically speaking, biologically speaking, a mammal's life cycle begins at the moment of the fertilization of the egg. And so that has been super helpful because, I mean, this is like geneticists will tell you that's when life begins. Life as in like human life or life of a dog or life as that species, right, begins at the moment of conception. So that's been very helpful because then it gets around the whole thing with, you know, does it look like a human being or does it have any qualities that we typically associate with a human person?
And that's one of the reasons why on the show we often talk about purpose, that you know, when we talk about a, like, for example, you talk about a machine, I know I've talked about this before, but it's a good reminder, that we don't define a machine by its parts. You know, we don't look at the machine on my wrist and say, oh, look at that. That's some nice glass, plastic, and metal you got there, right? You know, we would say, no, it's a watch, or it's a computer, or it's a car. We understand that purpose defines what a thing is, especially when we're talking again about composite things. And that's what you see in human life, that this fertilized egg has a purpose, and that purpose is human life. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're not even talking about the image of God or anything like that yet. Like, we're not bringing in some of our Christian presuppositions.
Yeah, we haven't made a theological argument yet.
So that's the part that I constantly remind my friends when I'm talking about this, because they assume that I'm saying this because I'm a Christian. But I'm like, no, all of the stuff that I cite, all of the arguments that I gave to you, where do I invoke God?
Now, I think this is interesting, though, to bring in the image of God theology, because as I've been thinking about this, and I'll just show some of my cards here, some things that I've been thinking through. The first thing that we already talked about was that people don't murder people. We've talked quite a bit about that. People murder monsters, monsters murder people. And what we're talking about there is, if you're going to willfully take another person's life, you first need to either take their humanity away from them or yourself. But if you keep their humanity and you keep your own, you're not going to be able to do it. Now, what's interesting with regards to this is what you find with all moral questions. Take the Ten Commandments. Like, if you're going to, people don't steal from people. You know, people don't cheat, you know, people. What you will do is you will first dehumanize them or yourself. Two, ultimately, when we talk about moral law, we're ultimately talking about breaking relationship with them. And what you see theologically is that you first need to break relationship with God, that image of God. You first break relationship with God, and it allows you then to break relationship with them. And this is what bothers me with this, with what we're seeing with abortion, of course, is it's a breaking of the image of God. It's breaking relationship with God and His natural purpose in human life, and in dehumanizing that baby into a fetus, so that you can kill it, so that you can do what you want with your body.
You're onto something. Thanks, no, but Daniel. I think like, well, with the Ten Commandments, right? With the person who is now broken, like they're no longer connected with God, right? And so now it allows them to break connection with humans. When they're stealing something, right, they're taking, but like, had they still had that relationship, you think the person A could have said, hey, I'm in need of this, can you help, right? And that would be a good thing. The person wouldn't be stealing because they would have relationship. And you could think about all the different like areas that people maybe kill for or do all this stuff for. If they were in relationship, they wouldn't have the need to be killing people. And then there you go. That's your utopia, right? Which is funny, because we're always chasing this naturalism utopia. If we get rid of religion, if we get rid of all this stuff, we'll have a utopia. But maybe if we actually treat each other like we're in the image of God, each one of us, maybe we would actually have that utopia. And I know people always say, that song, we'll make heaven a place on earth.
Right.
Right.
Well, and that's the challenge, isn't it? Ultimately, where all of this is going is what do you do with what's going on? What do you do with Planned Parenthood and abortion? And I mean, we live in a really depressing culture at times. I mean, we're in a culture that kills babies. And you're like, man, what do I do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You shine the image of God in this life. That's what you do.
Amen.
You shine what it looks like to have a relationship with God, and how it informs your ontology, how it informs, you know, your love for people, for what exists, right? That you are seeing the image of God in people, that you are substantiating their humanity. Because I mean, this is the one of the challenges that we face, isn't it, Steve, Daniel? When you're trying to argue against abortion, I mean, you know, where does theology come into the conversation? Because at some level, the only way this will stop is when that child is humanized.
Right.
When the child is humanized, it will stop, and the person has to be humanized. Because I mean, there are people out there, there are monsters out there that will keep the image there. And they will dehumanize themselves in the process of taking that life. But that's the challenge that's set before us, isn't it? That we as we seek to be the image of, you know, to shine that image of God in this life, and also to substantiate. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think you're definitely making sense. I would also add to that too, just quickly, that even, I guess it is the general revelation, right? Our conscience. And I think the good thing about this is that everybody, when they see a baby, they know that it's a baby, right? It's a human person. Just the other day, I had this little figurine of an 11-week-old unborn baby, and my daughter saw it, and immediately she said, "Is that my baby? Is that my baby?" So we let her play with that for a bit. And a 3-year-old understood right away when she saw it, this is a little baby, right?
Wow.
And this is the kind of stuff that a 3-year-old gets that we as adults have to educate ourselves into imbecility.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about it is that even people that don't believe in God, when they see somebody, they recognize the humanity of that person. And I would argue that we actually have to convince ourselves otherwise to deprive that person of that humanity.
Absolutely.
So what that means is that as you talk to your friends, as you go out there, you know, and stand for, you know, the rights of the preborn and things like that, don't be discouraged just because, you know, we're talking to a secular culture. It is built into us to recognize the humanity of other people, even the ones that don't necessarily look like
and
us.
And don't dehumanize yourself in the process.
Indeed. Yeah.
Okay, so here, last question then, Andy. If someone comes up to you and asks you, say, why are you pro-life? What would you say?
Well, ultimately, what we've been talking about this whole show, really, is that I am pro-life because I want to see a culture of life flourishing.
Yeah.
I want to see the purpose of life playing out as people are coming together, man and woman, to make life and to see that life flourish in the context of family as God created it to be, knowing that when we live in the purpose that God created us to be in, that is our best good and will lead ultimately to our flourishing, both individually and as a society.
All right. That's, again, we're just kind of scratching the surface and there's a lot more to think about, but we'll just end it there because we're out of time. And if you're wondering, you know, what more can I do? What are some things that I can practically do? There are some resources that we can offer you. I'll put them up on the show notes so you can go there, check out some organizations and other books and other resources. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more to think about.